Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you guys for having me come down here and be with you tonight. It's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to thank my friend Billy for his kind words and stuff like that. And my host, Richard, who picked me up at the airport. Where are you at? He left, the son of a... There goes my ride home. Oh, there he is back there. Rich is kind of a quick guy. He picked me up at the airport at about 5, and I made the mistake of asking him how he's doing. He just stopped about 5 minutes ago telling me, you know. And when you ride with Rick, you got to pay attention, because when he points out things, he's going to be looking at it too, you know, and he's driving, you know. But I want to thank him for his hospitality, and I'm just glad to be out of my own car, really. I had a hell of a ride to the airport. It seemed like I was fighting with my glove box, and you know how that is, you know, and that thing wouldn't stay closed. So I kept slamming it, and it kept plopping open. So I thought I would speed up and slam it and turn it and lock it, and the thing kept plopping open. So I turned the radio off, brought it up slowly, slammed it, locked it, and it plopped open. Now, the idea of leaving the damn thing alone never entered my mind, you know. We're going to work on that thing, you know, all the way to the airport. And as I stand here tonight, the glove box is wide open over there at the airport. But I got a long ride home. And I figure this time it'll be different, you know. I don't know about surrender. Seems like we're in a... Is this a high school? Huh? Grammar school? Yeah, I did bad in both of them. I don't have any fond memories of high school. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for a little over 23 years and not amount to a damn thing, you know. I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser, you know, and I've always been a loser, and I've prided myself on being a loser, you know, and I remember being in high school, and it was something like this, and I remember being a freshman. I remember being in the principal's office because I got brought up for being drunk on campus, and I'm sitting there in the principal's office with my father. And we're sitting there, and my dad sees this picture of the star quarterback up on the wall. And he says, "Hey, jackass," he says, "why don't you try to be like Coy, the quarterback?" And I looked at a guy and I said, "All right, I'll try, you know." And next year, I'm in the principal's office, and I got arrested for selling barbiturates and being drunk on campus. And I drove the janitor's cart through the library doors. I had to get that book back, you know, And me and my dad and my probation officer are sitting in the principal's office, and the principal says, "Why don't you try to be like Coy, you know?" I said, "All right." Next year, my big sister starts dating some guy, and she brings him over. And it's old number 7 right there on my couch, you know. And my mom comes running over in her moo-moo, and she says, "Why don't you try to be like Coy, for Christ's sakes, you know?" My senior year, I'm in the Torrance jail getting ready to do 90 days. And somebody slides the Daily Breeze newspaper in there, and it says, "Coy makes all pro CIF, you know. And I go, "God, I'd like to be like Coy, you know." And lo and behold, what goes around comes around in old A&A town. I'm about 5 years sober, and I'm in my plumbing van downtown Los Angeles, and it seems like it's vogue in L.A. that on every street corner, there's a guy selling oranges or peanuts, or he has this cardboard sign that says, "I'll work for food," like you don't, you know. And I look like a guy that needs help all the time. People are always giving me pamphlets telling me that Jesus and Jehovah are coming any minute now and I should see them and stuff, you know. And I look like a guy that needs help. And it's a hot day and this guy's holding this sign and we lock eyes. And I go, "Oh, shit." You know, I got $2 and this guy ain't getting it, you know, because I'm the cookie lady at my meeting, you know. I'm a giver, you know. And he comes racing over to my car with that sign and he pokes his head in my van and he goes, "Larry, Larry Thomas." And I go, "Coy," you know. Go out for a long one, you son of a bitch, you know. I mean, you know, I thought this guy had it made. And then it dawned on me that if there was any justice in AA, that maybe my sponsor could write this guy a letter saying, hey, why don't you try to be like Larry, you know? I mean, people have always had it made. Everybody always looked like they grasp and develop a manner of living with ease, man. And I'm just a clown that just... I just couldn't handle it, man. Everything was tough going, you know. And I come from a great home, you know. I was born in Detroit, and I come out to California when I was about 4 years old, brought up in a foster home for a little bit, and I had I still do. I got a great little mom, a little Scandinavian lady, and my mom loved speed. My mom loved eating those diet pills and running around the house around 4 o'clock in the morning and running out in the garage and sorting out nuts and bolts all night, you know, and... getting the prescription pill, you know, filled, and then just getting the power edger and doing the whole goddamn block, you know, and just a busy lady, man. And you could hear her up all night just going to town, man, you know. You'd peek in her room, and she's got that look of determination, you know, like that, you know. And she had a hobby. She had a lot of hobbies, but if she got them down to two, you know, her favorite one was making afghans. You know, she loved to make afghans, and everything in that house had a fresh afghan. Chairs had afghans, couches had afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodles she knit, you know, and if you go in the bathroom, you know, they got a toilet paper with a poodle with big eyes on it, you know, and any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know, and just a busy lady, man, and I loved her to death. And she had a hobby, and her hobby was making these big jigsaw puzzles. She loved to get that prescription bottle filled and go to Save-On's and get her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had the coupons on the back. And she saved those coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, man, you know. And she'd get her this big puzzle, a 30 million piece puzzle of the Mojave Desert, you know. She don't want to be bothered with any color tonight, man. It's just going to be a clean shot, you know. And she owed one moo-moo her entire life, you know, and that thing was wearing thin. And she'd come home and take a couple more Dexies, start putting together this damn puzzle. And if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers, and she's going to snip that son of a, you know, and... this thing is going together tonight, baby, you know, and I love my, and you grow up living with mom tales, you know, don't play in the gutter, you'll get polio, you know, burnt food is good for your gums was a famous one in that house, you know, and, because there was always burnt food, let me tell you know, and you'd be racing out of the house at 6 o'clock in the morning, come back here, you little, so, you know, don't, you know, she said she'd have some toast for me, and it was just flaming, you know, and, don't you make that face, that burnt toast is good for your gums, you know. Now, she don't have a tooth in her head, you know, but here, have it, Mom, my God, you know. And I had a great, and I love my mom to this day, and I knew back then, as goofy as I was and as busy as she was, that I knew my mom loved me. No question about being loved by my mom. And that was to set up a pattern that would follow me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is, when anybody would give me any ounce of attention or affection, well, I played her like a fiddle up until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever want to forget that there was nothing to keep me from laying the touch on her. I don't ever want to forget that. I don't want to ever forget that thing that would stand in front of her after coming out of an institution for 6 months or a year. And I remember this day as clear as being picked up by the airport tonight. I'm standing in a parking lot, and I got my street mud on, and my mom hadn't seen me for about 6-7 months. And I'm in this parking lot, and she's working in the dry cleaners. She's always had jobs, you know, and she just had a hell of a work ethic. And I remember locking eyes with her, and the only thought that I had is, you better have a dollar. And I remember making that walk and locking eyes with her and seeing her trembling and going through that little coin purse. Just to get it. And I remember as she's going through that little coin purse, there's a little picture of me when I was 8 years old. Because that was the only decent memory she had of me. And for her to get out that little dollar like that. And I often wonder, how come when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you place a secretary that same distance, how come I can't walk that distance and ask for a commitment? But I can walk up to my mom and break her heart. See, that's the kind of selfishness and self-centeredness that I had to get rid of here. If my alcoholism don't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. And the longer I stay sober, the more selfish I can become. I wished it would go away, but I'm an alcoholic. My head don't care that, my head don't want the obsession removed. My head's dead set against it. I got the type of head that no matter how tired I am, I'll lay my head down tonight at 2:30 and I'll hear this, "Hey, wake up. I know you're there. Let's chat." "Yeah, I want to talk about when you were a baby and bring you right up to date, for Christ's sakes, you know." You know. And the only frustrating thing about that is we just did it the night before, you know. My head don't care, man, you know. And my head's always had power over me. And I've always believed it. For years I used to think it was on my side. It don't care, man, you know. My dad was a hard-working guy. My dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He loved to drink and he loved to sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, man. And he'd be sneaking through my bedroom window. He's a refinery worker, so you never know when he's coming in, you know. But I can tell because I can feel his boot coming on my chest as he's coming through my window, you know. And I remember grabbing that thing one night and I said, "Why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know? My God, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, I can hear the Hoover going now, for Christ's sake, you know." And oh, man, and my dad was my idol. My dad was my idol, man, you know, because he made being a man the thing to do. And he was a hard-working guy, and he had a hell of a life, man, you know. You don't know how good you got it, kid. Back when I was your age, we had it tough. And he did have it tough, man. He brought up over there in Ohio and Detroit. His father died, choked on his tongue at a young age. His mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. He brought up his kid brother doing side jobs, and he had a dream. And that dream was to get my mom out of that convent, marry her, and bring her out to California. Yeah. Yeah, and live that good life. That's what everybody was talking about then, man, was that, you know, that California dream, man. Things are happening in California. And he went into the Navy. He lied about his age. He went into the Navy, man, and he loved the Navy. And he loved talking about World War II and Midway and Pearl Harbor and everything like that, you know. And he just made a being a man like, you know. And, man, I swear to God, the best year of my life was when I was 10. When I was 10, man, I was an excellent baseball player. I was going all over the state. I was in junior lifeguards because I could run like a deer. I had little girlfriends. I had a host of friends. And I was on top of the world, man. And then the 11 years came along, and all of this was gone. My ego wasn't massaged anymore. I didn't have people telling me how wonderful I was. I didn't have the adulation of friends and the girls and all that outside stuff that used to make me feel good. And I got lost and I got scared. And at 11 years old, I started bringing up these brick walls between me and my dad because I started feeling that I'm not going to cut it as being a man. And I started holding that in. I didn't know how to talk to my dad. And I'd hear my mom and dad in this little house, this small little house that we had over there in Torrance and Gardena with these paper-thin walls, and they would say stuff like, "Where did we go wrong? What could we do to make him better? He's really, you know, he's not doing well. Where did we go wrong, Betty? What should we do?" And never once did I go, "Hey, open up, man. You guys are doing okay. It's all my fault." I let them ride that for as long as I could. And the thing that drove me nuts is that there was nothing in that home that they provided me that could validate how crazy I feel. Oh, yeah, I could bring up some little incidences and stuff like that and just be tops in a discussion meeting. But, you know, there was nothing to validate how crazy I felt. And I started feeling ashamed because they were providing me everything, and I should feel a lot better. And I have spent my entire life with one dream, even when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is one of these days, I'm going to think and I'm going to feel and I'm going to be normal because I know there's something about me that isn't. Because I can do everything that all these other kids are doing, but when I'm by myself, I'm a little bit restless. and I'm irritable, and I'm discontented, and I'm not quite right, and I don't know how to talk to people in my family, and I feel so damn different all the time from everybody around me. And 11 years old, there's four of us in a garage, and we start passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, I felt normal. I took a shot of that Four Rose whiskey, and it just turned Howdy Doody into James Dean in two drinks, man. And I love the effect produced by alcohol, man. I love how it shut off my head, untightened my gut, and for 15 minutes I was all right. I wasn't on top of the world, but I wasn't on the bottom, but I was right in the middle. And for that short period of time, man, it felt better than any home run I'd ever hit. And I knew everything was all right. And I didn't head out to Skid Row that next day, but I certainly did get the address. And I knew where to find it, man. And I was always be preoccupied with that feeling that I got from that drunk. I now had a reference point to this crazy life that I was living of what feeling good is and what happiness is. And for the first time in my life, I could connect happiness with something. And it was a shot of Four Rose whiskey, and it never failed me. And my freshman year in high school, I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers, and her brothers like car shows and lowered Chevrolets. And I started getting my hair up real big and driving around in these lowered Chevrolets and listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson. And God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn truck, man. I loved it. I had a Mexican girlfriend named Loopy, and she curled up her hair real big, and I'd get my hair up real big with my white T-shirt, my black khaki pants, you know, and somewhere along the line, somebody told me that men with big, you know, were well endowed, had big feet, so I had a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know, and driving around with my big hair and my big feet, man, just, orderly, you know, I loved it, man. Yeah, I had some guy trip over my feet tonight, and I felt proud, you know. You know, and we'd drive around drinking that red port wine, man, and just wondering what the hell you're staring at, you know. And now I know, man, you know, and God, everything I'd ever need, I'd find in that lowered Chevrolet, me and those lowriders, man, and I loved it. I loved it to death. I ran into a kid like that not too long ago, man. I was over there in California a couple of years ago in the Glendale Mall. This kid comes walking by me. He's got a bald head. He's all shaved. He's got a tank top on. He's got all these tattoos. He's got these big pants that you could put about four guys in. He's got three beepers because he's an important kid, you know. I walk by him. He got his mom's earrings on. He's got a diamond in his nose. He's got a ring in this nose. He's got a ring in that nose. He's got a ring in his lip. He's got a chain to his wallet. Got a ball bearing in his tongue. I walk by him. He goes, "What are you looking at?" I said, "I don't have a goddamn clue what I'm looking at, you know." Beats the hell out of me what I'm looking at, son, you know. And now I sponsor the little guy, you know, and he's out there in Oceanside, called me the other day. He says, "What do you want me to do?" I says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, I don't know what." I says, "Well, why don't you just unlock yourself, for Christ's sake, you know?" And he says, "Yeah, but I'm going to these meetings, man, and I'm sitting in these meetings, and I feel so different." I said, "No kidding, man. Maybe you're the only one in a chain link fence. I don't know, you know." But I understand what that's about, man. It ain't about... I've been a man of images my entire life, man. I had a little loser image, little lowrider image, little drunk image, you know. And come to AA, have that little slipper image. And then I had my ace in the hole, and that was my hostility. Anything to keep them out. That's what it was about for me. It wasn't about being bad. It was about building something there to keep you from getting in, because if you get in, you're going to find out what a pukey, weak son of a gun I really am. And I don't have the hint of knowledge about being a man. Always having to bluff myself into situations, bluffing myself into relationships, bluffing myself into jobs, always having to lie myself in the situation, and then living in that tremendous fear that you're going to be found out, and they do find out, but that's okay because you got something over there you've already planned. And that's what you do when you're always bluffing. You're never living a truth. It's always a lie. You're always on the run. Always got your little Vons bag ready to go. You know what I mean? And you don't know nothing about responsibility. You're afraid of commitment. Somebody even mentions 401k to you. You're out of town, man, you know? You know? And you grow up your entire life like a guy like me, demanding to feel special all the time. You've got to be treated wonderful all the time. You're the type of guy who not only is an alcoholic, you got a big belt of lazy ass that straps around you, you know. And people, you know, you do chores around the house and people got to pay you tons of money or give you amounts of, you know, recognition for doing what you're supposed to do. I'm the type of guy who does 8 hours of work. I do average things expecting standing ovations. Yeah, I go to work and I think the boss is in the office going, "Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, man, that guy's really something, man. He put in 8 hours. Oh, they don't make them like that anymore, you know. Oh, yeah, we got to keep the mold on that guy, man, you know. Half hour lunch, Jesus, on time? Where do they get these guys, you know?" And I'm like that today, man. I'm like that today. I put a toilet seat on for my wife about 4 months ago, you know. And she's a busy lady in AA, loves the hell out of Billy. And we're coming home from our meeting, and I put that toilet seat on, and she'd go to the bathroom, and I'd be in bed waiting. Jesus, come on, Rosie. My God. Get out of yourself, lady. You're sitting on a brand new piece of cherry wood in there, man. You know? What do they teach you in AA? Look around. Get out of yourself, man, you know? That's a brand new toilet seat there. Who do you think put it on there? God? Hell no, man. That was Lawrence of Torrance had put that damn thing on there, man. You know? I finally had to tell her, you know? I said, "That's a brand new toilet." She says, "I know, and it's loose, too." I said, they're never happy. They're just never happy, these women here. You bust your butt every day, and there's more stuff to do, you know? I can't believe it, you know, and I've been like that my entire life, man. But I drank that whiskey and I rode around with those guys and I was on top of the world, man. I knew me and Peach and Pooch and Loopy were going to drive off into the sunset forever. I remember being in driver's education. You're a sophomore or a junior, or depending if you're graduate moving along or not, you know. And I remember having to take driver's education in the summer because I'm always getting kicked out of regular school, going to continuation school, GED when I'm 2 years sober finally, you know. And I remember in the driver's education class when you're in high school, they always have the biggest coach in the world driving with you, some football coach or something like that. And I remember one summer day, he says, "All right, Thomas, it's your turn to drive. Get into the car." So I get my hair into the car, you know, and there's three girls in the back seat of this thing. And he goes, "All right, kid," he says, "pull out and go over there and parallel park." So I go over there and I parallel park, get that thing in there. He says, "Good job." He says, "You know, why don't you drive to Torrance Boulevard? I want to buy everybody in the car some Pepsi." Oh, what a cool coach. I drive over to Torrance Boulevard to the Jack in the Box, pull up to the Jack in the Box, and I totally forget that 15 minutes before class, I took four of what they then call Tylenols. And I didn't know what the hell they were. I'm just minding my own business, doing a little heroin and drinking some wine, minding my own business. Some guy gave me four of these things, and I don't know what they are, so I took them all, you know. And I don't want to be caught with anything, so I took them all, you know. And there's some kind of barbiturate, you know. You're knocked out telling the truth is what you're doing. It's just every Al-Anon's dream, you know. And I don't know what's happening to me, but he has me pull up to the, he says, "Pull up to the Jack in the Box and order." So I pull up to the Jack in the Box, and boom, these things nail me, man. I'm spinning around. I can't talk. I look over there. There's four coaches now, you know. He says, "What's wrong with you?" He says, "Drive up to the puppet and order." Well, I can't see the puppet, man, you know. I can hear the puppet. He's yelling at me, "Can I have your order, please?" You know. So I drive, I'm trying to find the puppet, and I hear this big crash, and this puppet's head's hanging down, you know. I run over the puppet at Jack in the Box, and the police come, and they throw my, you know, they throw me on the hood of the car, and they shatter my hair all over the place. And I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal, man. I'll let Rudy drive all night, man. And when you're riding shotgun and drinking that port wine, there's one thing that'll keep an alky's attention, and that's finding himself in a mirror. Oh, Jesus, I found myself in that rearview mirror, and I couldn't believe how good-looking I was. My God! You ought to be an underwear model or something like that, you know? I'd drink a little more wine, my hair would get bigger, my eyes would get bluer. I'd go, what am I doing with these Mexicans, man, you know? And I look at myself, and I see all these cigarette butts stuck in my hair, you know? And I see a big chunk of vomit on my T-shirt, and I feel like dancing when I look like that, you know? And never once when me and Rudy were driving around drinking that wine, never once were we driving down Whittier Boulevard did I ever nudge him and go, "Rudy, I'm feeling inadequate." It never happened, man, you know. Never happened because I was right there when I drank. Alcohol put me right where I needed to go, you know. And around 1969, all my buddies are going places. Some of them are going to Vietnam, and some of them are turning hippie and going to San Francisco. I wonder what I'm going to do with my life. So I thought that me and my buddy would go to Detroit and find my roots. And so we head out to Detroit, and we landed in Phoenix. And I was over there off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel. And the Apache Hotel is about six floors and $40 a month. Everybody's got a hot plate and a hot TV, you know, and everybody's got a big TV and it's in the lobby. Everybody's got a bathroom and it's down the hall. And I used to just stare out that Apache window and just drink and dream and die, and knowing one of these days it ain't going to be like that. One of these days, man, my life is going to be normal, you know. Just like it was when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had that illusion. And isn't it amazing? To this day, I see people come to my home group and other meetings. And to the untrained eye, if you're new, AA must look something like this. That people come here, they stop drinking, they get a little job, they get a little apartment, they get a little car, they get a little somebody to squeeze and dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. Yet there's more people pursuing those material things, sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they finally get these things, and they wonder why they're a little restless, and they wonder why they're a little irritable, and they wonder why they're a little discontented, and they look around, and they see these got these things, but they got this gut that won't stop churning, they got this head that won't stop pounding, and they wonder why they're feeling like that, and they begin to tell themselves, well, maybe I need something other than AA, when they haven't even begun to treat their alcoholism. That one more time, all they're doing is satisfying the material instincts. And that's never been a treatment for alcoholism. What that does for me and you, it makes us sitting ducks for medication. It makes us sitting ducks for thinking that AA don't work. And the treatment for alcoholism, whether you're drunk or whether you're rich or poor, wife or no wife, is putting that book into your life. The magical triangle isn't so much unity, service, and recovery. The magical triangle in AA is something that's getting lost almost over the years. And it's called you and your sponsor and that book. Identification. The magical thing of identification. One alcoholic talking to another, applying that book to his life. So that no matter what's happening in his life, he can feel peaceful. He can have a little ease with him. Have a little bit of hope in here that his life isn't, his sobriety, as the book says, isn't precarious. It isn't dependent on other things. It's dependent on his actions in Alcoholics Anonymous and only his actions in alcohol, regardless of what's coming down the chute, man. I've got a guy that 12-stepped me in 1975, and his sponsor is up in Oregon somewhere. Had 46 years. Now he's wrestling to get 8 weeks in a detox. And Alex asked him, he says, my God, what happened? You had so many years. And he says, you bet. I had a lot of years, but I didn't have any days, Alex. I wasn't doing what you do to get days here. And it's doing the things that get you days that get you the years. You see, I can't stay sober on things I did 4 years ago. Every day I got a daily reprieve. Every day I got to do certain things. I'm 23 years sober and it ain't enough. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're feeling restless and irritable and discontented and you may be a little depressed, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous in that magical chapter. Sit down with somebody, preferably a sponsor, and read the doctor's opinion. It'll nail you to the T. And it starts talking about people. But what about me? What about me, you'll say. You say, I'm on these antidepressants. They've got a little chapter in there. It says, and then there's the type, the manic depressive, which a whole chapter could be written about. And we've seen these people recover. And these are the people that a whole chapter could be written about. And then it talks about that the only answer we have is entire abstinence. And then it has that paragraph that nailed me. This starts a seething cauldron of debate. You bet. I've been debating abstinence my entire life. Abstinence is why I drank. I couldn't stand the way that I felt when I was sober. Sobriety would drive me to drink time and time and time again. And I would not drink, and I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd sit in these rooms like this, and I wasn't drinking, and I'd sit in these rooms, and I'd see these little jerks with these ties on going, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. And I'm like, my God, I came in with that guy, you know. And I thought for surely that once I'd get my life in order, that sobriety would come to me. Always dependent on something else. always dependent on something else, man. You know, and I'm over there in Phoenix, and I hook up with a guy, and I'm over there at the Apache Hotel, and I start working for this plumber, and I fake a knee injury, and then I get some prescriptions filled, you know, and then I meet up with a guy over there at the Wagon Wheel Bar, and a little guy from Louisiana, or something. Larry, he says, I know how we're going to make some money. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds, and you're going to be a jockey. I said, wow, you know, I'm thinking I'm going to be working out or something like that, you know, and I'm just drinking some cheap wine and stuff, and he gave me a bag of some methamphetamine, and I'd never taken that stuff. I've just been doing a little heroin and drinking some wine, you know, and he says, here, I want you to take this stuff, and in 2 months we're going to come back, and I'm going to weigh you in, you know, and the guy took off, and he come back in a week, and I'm in the same spot. I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any goddamn horse I've ever seen in my life, you know. And I'm locked in my room. I won't leave my room. I'm chasing flies around my room, you know. And I'm looking out my window because I'm seeing these black and white flashes, and that's the sun going up and down, you know. And he comes back. You couldn't have possibly taken all that. Oh, yeah, all this shit's gone, Ernie, you know. And so we canned that idea, and I went to work for another plumber, and I faked a knee injury at the guy. And anyway, I started hooking up with these guys, and we started writing prescriptions and selling them. And I started writing prescriptions and selling them and Social Security cards. And after about 9 months, they found me over there in Tucson. And when you're loaded on barbiturates and whiskey, there's no freeway chase. You know, there he goes. You know, it's just a matter of the sheriff coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, oh, shit, there he is down there. You know? And so they arrested me and convicted me, and they put me away. They put me away for about 9 months in southern Arizona. And after 9 months, they gave me a $45 voucher on the Continental Trailways and sent me out to Los Angeles again. And I checked in L.A. They gave me a $40 voucher for the Greyhound Hotel in downtown Torrance, put me on Anabuse. After about a week off of Anabuse, I started feeling pretty good. And after about a month, I'm on my own. And about a little over a month, I'm stone cold sober. And they find me in a Little League dugout over there in El Segundo, California at 10 o'clock in the morning in between maniacal and hysterical. And I've never been in that place before in my life. And I was frightened to death because I couldn't say anything. I just started turning inward and I didn't know what to do. And I just lost all contact with reality. I didn't know. I was just a trembling wreck. And I'd love to say it was DTs, but it was a little more. And then they took me to the Harvard General Hospital. They diagnosed that some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts and that maybe I need to go to a state hospital over there by Oxnard to be observed for 30 days. And they kept me for 12 months. And after 12 months, I come out of there totally observed. And they gave me my antipsychotics. They gave me my antidepressants. And they gave me my anti-anxiety pills. And they said, you're not going to be able to operate out in society unless you take these things. And I had no reason to debate it. And after 2 months, I ran out of Thorazine, and they found me over at Alvaro Street in downtown Los Angeles, a public drunk, a public nuisance. And they rolled me up, and they sent me up to Wayside over there for about 3 months. After 3 months, they put about 40 of us in a black and white bus. They sent us down to the South Bay Courthouse. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm in a holding tank about this size. There's only me and bologna sandwiches. I'm sitting on a concrete floor. I'm all by myself with my Vons bag and no hope. And I'm listening for the only thing that I hope I can hear on that concrete floor is maybe some keys. Some keys coming down to roll open that door. And sure enough, that cell opens up and there's a Scottish man with a patch standing there. And he says, are you Larry Thomas? And I said, yes, sir, I am. He says, hello, son. He says, my name is Alex. He says, why don't you come with me, son? You're going to AA. I said, AA? Now, those are two initials I've never heard of before. I've heard of OR and PO, you know, but... AA, that's the other end of the alphabet, you know, and who's this pirate all of a sudden? That's some kind of hallucination, you know. And the sweetest man in the world that ever crossed my eyes was this guy named Alex. And I want to tell you about him. He had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't a part of the court. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't part of the judge. He wasn't a part of any system. He had no business being there. The guy was a refinery worker who just gotten the worst news of his life, and that his wife was passing away immediately of a terminal disease. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. And he didn't know what to do. But somewhere in his book studies, somewhere in his 12 and 12, somewhere in working with others, he grasped and he come to believe in that first paragraph of working with others, that nothing will keep us immune from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when other activities fail. And he knew he needed a new guy. He needed one. And he went down to that South Bay courthouse. He talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, "We got a guy back there." And he come rustling back down there. Now, to me, to this very, very night, that is the epitome of being a trusted servant. A trusted servant isn't nothing you get elected to, or you get nominated to. That's one of the very first things Alcoholics Anonymous gives you when you're new. We're trusting you. We're trusting you that you're going to tote this message. We're trusting you that you're going to carry this message. And you're not going to sell it. You're not going to change it. You're not going to get anything out of it. But you're going to go ahead and you're going to carry this message. The pure message of Alcoholics Anonymous, that when one drunk talks to another, they both seem to get a little bit better here. They both seem to get a little bit of something that they've never gotten before, and that's some hope. The idea of not drinking wasn't astonishing to the alcoholic because he can't party anymore. When you say, "I can't drink anymore," and I come to believe that, I'm giving up every little ounce of hope that I'm ever going to survive out there again. That was my only link to hope, was that drink. And now you're telling me to give that up. You better give me something. And you did. You gave me trust. You gave me this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, man. And that's what Alex was doing down there. The epitome of being a trusted servant. And he came down and he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to a little 15-minute car ride. And in that car ride, he was your biggest cheerleader. He talked you up a storm. He says, "I can't wait for you to meet these guys, Larry. You're going to love these guys." And he says, "I know you've had a hell of a life, but," he says, "I don't want you to ever feel that you're so bad that you don't belong here. Don't use that as your corner to feel different." And isn't that the truth of the alcoholic? That no matter where we are, even in AA or outside of, we have the ability to always feel a little bit different. We can always find something about us that doesn't make us quite like the other guys. And he says, "I want you to know something about Alcoholics Anonymous." He says, "I know you feel different." He says, "But in Alcoholics Anonymous, Larry, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are." He says, "Nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted." He says, "That's just what your wife says when she sees you leave, man, you know." He says, "That's the way you come in here." And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975, rolled up to this little club called the TLC Club in Torrance, introduced me to a little lady named Moose, an Indian genie, and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill, Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people, man. Little Moose come running after me like a toilet paper commercial. She says, "Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are. Man, I'm not it, you know." And this big transvestite came out of the card room, and he started circling me like a helicopter, and he finally landed. And he said, "You know, I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so." not till I get a year anyway, you know, and... And I told Alex, I said, "Jesus Christ, that guy's got big feet, you know." And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis, getting physically sober and mentally ill, 30 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk, 90 days and get drunk. And the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin. And every time I came back, every time I came back, I was desperate. And every time I came back, I wanted to stay. Isn't it frightening to the alcoholic when he finally buys the deal? He finally says, "You got it, man. I'm all set. Whatever you want me, I want to quit." And he can't. See, the idea in my life that I'm an alcoholic for so many years was, I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink. And what I've come to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous for me, that I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to drink. I am flat going to drink. And there is not a human condition, there's not a human atmosphere in the world that'll keep me from drinking unless I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the only hope, because I am going to drink. I see it happening around me with great regularity. We got more people leaving than coming in, for Christ's sakes. And I hope I'm doing my job. I hope I am a responsible one. I hope I'm not so held up with my ego and my home group that I'm afraid to leave my circle of guys and look for a fresh face. I hope I'm not so caught up in my home group that I don't do any of the little chores. I hope I'm not so caught up in my home group that after I get 5 years sober, I don't think I need to do any commitments. See, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, man, you know. Everything about Alcoholics Anonymous goes against the grain, baby, which is why it works so good, I tell you. Because in here, we do the uncomfortable to get comfortable. I didn't wake up this morning and go, yeah, I get to go to Las Vegas, man. You know, everything in my head says, I'm not going. I'm in the shower. I'm not going. I'm not going. Bob's going to be there. Billy's going to be there. I'm not going. I'm not going. I'm not going. And I tell you what, Alcoholics Anonymous took the only decent thing that was left in my body, and it was my feet. And they train my feet. So regardless of what my head's saying, I am trained to do certain things in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is why it's so important to me. I don't know about anybody else, but my happiness is in my rut. My rut in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sounds lame, sounds boring, but I seem to live more peaceful knowing where I'm going to be on Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. When I know where I'm supposed to be, I got to have those kind of things, committed meetings, where I've got jobs and I should show up. Because I know I'm going to be goofy. But there's nothing like being goofy during the day and floating into your home group at evening and being around other people that have been goofy all day. You know what I mean? And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, the saddest thing to see is you trying to hang on to your old chums that are getting loaded. Try to find some people who are getting sober in AA and hang around with. Don't try to be a friend with your sponsor. The biggest mistake I ever made was trying to be friends with my sponsor. I was always trying to win his approval. Always trying to please Johnny. And you know what happens when you try to get a sponsor's approval? You start holding back on shit because you don't want him to think bad of you. You start holding back on little nuggets. And pretty soon, you got a little bundle of nuggets. Pretty soon, you got a little envelope full of secrets. But not your sponsor. Don't seek his approval. He knows you're a fool. You know what I mean? You know? Get with your buddies, man. Be honest with your sponsor. Take your problems to your sponsor. Bring your solutions to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hang around your buddies that you can drive around and fart with and go to meetings, man, and talk about your sponsor. You know what I mean? That guy telling you that same stuff too, you know? And that's what I do, man. I live in my rut. I love my rut in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I'm going to be goofy. I know I'm a quack. But, man, there's nothing like floating into my home group. A home group that sees me do chores there. I'm not too big to do chores in my home group. I'm still washing coffee pots. I'm still a cookie lady on Thursday. I'm not too big to do chores in my home. That's my home. Home is where I hang my hat. Home is where you come and visit me, and I'll give you a seat, and we'll give you coffee, and I'll thank you for coming by. And I do my chores in my home group so that you'll feel comfortable and welcome in my home group, as if it was my home. If you were to come to my home in L.A., at the end of the evening, I wouldn't say, hey, would you help me clean the bathroom? And so I do those things so I can recreate an atmosphere in Alcoholics Anonymous called the home group. The home group atmosphere, the only atmosphere where a guy like me can stay sober, where I come into a room like this and they're laughing and they're joking and they're farting and they're having fun and everybody's having their night in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's unmistakably best place for me to be, because no matter how hard I fight getting here, once I sit in that seat, and once I shake a couple hands, and once I have a couple swigs of your coffee, and I hear the chapters being read, and the traditions being read, there is a peace that comes over me that I've been looking for all my life. There's a peace that comes with me, and thank God I'm not one of these jackasses that jumps up in front of you while you're trying to listen to the meeting, and maybe keeps you from hearing that. Thank God we got well-mannered meetings, because to people like me who don't know much about meditation, this is my meditation. When I read that 11-step prayer, and old St. Francis hit it, didn't he? When he starts describing St. Francis and he reads that prayer, he's not describing a place up on a hill for me to meditate. You know what he described for me? He described to me the excellent atmosphere of an AA meeting. That's exactly what's supposed to be going on here. That's exactly what we do here. And what a life it is. What a life it is, man. May 2nd, 1982. I'm checking into a... And you tell you what, about being a slipper, going in and out of... That didn't make me a worse alky or a better member. But what it did is teach me a powerful lesson. that if I don't change, my sobriety date will. And I don't have the power to change. But something happens when I'm with you. I had to admit that I had to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And that I'm totally powerless. I can't handle my life drunk and I can't handle it sober. I can't manage my own life. And I start identifying with these chapters. And then I start identifying with the doctor's opinion and Bill. Start identifying with that goofy stockbroker. But he nailed me. He talked about the hideous four horsemen, which is what I feel when I'm sober. And then they talked about there's a solution. And identifying with that book, and I couldn't deny, because that's my identification. That's my book. That's the book about the alcoholic. That's a book about alcoholism. And on May 2nd, 1982, I'm going by a war with into it. I check into the mission down there in Wilmington off of Beacon Light, the Beacon Light mission off of Beacon and Wilmington. And there's this guy doing his 12-step work in Torrance. And I locked eyes with this thing in the window, and I'm 120 pounds, and I'm yellow. I got my shoes tied to my pants, and I got my Mad Dog bottle in my back pocket, and I'm wondering whatever happened to my dreams. All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman, and I did what I always did when I looked like that and got like that. I panhandled some money, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a hold of Central Office. I said, "Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the mission down here in Wilmington. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me?" And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, "No." He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. He says, "Why don't you get your rusty ass down here? I'm tired of chasing after you." And he hung up. I said, "My God, whatever happened to my AA love?" I just heard it. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me to take an action. It wasn't up for the good people in AA to come get me, to come out of their warm little house. It was up to me to walk that 10 miles. It was up to me to not only pray, but to behave like a man that prayed. And I walked that 10 miles with my poopy pants and no hope, and I waddled up to that club, pound on that door. I asked if Don was in there. They said he's in the back room. I says, "If it would interest you, I'd like to go talk to him." And I walked up to that man, and I asked that man something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I says, "Don, I don't have an idea what to do with my life anymore. I don't know what to do." I says, "Would you be my sponsor?" And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds, and then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. And under no certain terms is he going to put up with my nonsense. And I followed that man. And that man had me stand up, and I shook it out with the drunks, and I hallucinated with the drunks, and I puked it out with the drunks. And I stood up that night, and I had some honey and orange juice, Cairo syrup. And they stood me up, shaken, alone, and afraid. And I was never so proud to be in the middle of you, because something happened in that last drunk. It wasn't my worst drunk, and it wasn't my longest drunk, but it was the drunk that drank away the debate of whether or not I'm going to do what you do. I had no other options. And for something happened to me is that Alcoholics Anonymous finally looked like a step up instead of a step down. And the most powerful step I ever took in Alcoholics Anonymous was the one towards you. Was the one towards you, where I got right down there in that, and I became proud to be a member. It was no longer an obligation to come to these meetings. Something happened over the years where it became a privilege. We begin looking around these meetings, and you begin grateful for this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it ain't so much something you have to do, something that you're proud to go do. Whether your head likes it or not, you know you go there. You know you're in the best thing. How grateful we are. Now, what are you going to do with a guy like me? I don't know nothing. I don't come from much. Alcoholics Anonymous made me a plumber. They took me right out of the gutter and stuck me in the middle of a sewer is what they did. But most of all, I'm a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous who is sponsored and have a home group. I've got a daughter I wasn't supposed to see that I'm seeing and watched her graduate. I got a beautiful wife that I met here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you this and then I'll sit down, I promise. I met my beautiful wife, Rosie, 9 years ago in a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was talking in Downey, and I couldn't get my eyes off this Nicaraguan lady. And at the end of the meeting, me and her were talking. And she says, "Do you like the backpack?" And I says, "I love it. I've never camped in my entire life." But I'm thinking anything to get into the tent, you know, and I've been calling that lady ever since. And I'm absolutely mad about this lady. And I know she loves me because she's a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous and she doesn't need me for nothing. And yet she still likes to hang around me. And I know I love her because she became the first woman that I tell other women about. And nothing more happier is when I leave that home, when I got to go off on the weekend or something and go talk, I make sure that her bed is made and that it smells like lavender and that those two roses are by her bedside. I don't ever want her to wonder where I'm at. I don't ever want her to wonder what I'm doing and what I'm at. I always want her to know that I'm by her side no matter where she's at. She loves Billy dearly. She loves him. She was so happy I was going to see him. You see? Now you're trying to wonder what I know is God's will. Do you never know what God's doing for you? How do you know you're in the answer that God has for you? I tell you how I know. I'm in the evidence. I'm in the evidence. Every time I'm around you, I see rows and rows and rows of people who should be dead and cast away and locked up. And right now I'm in the middle of the most powerful evidence I ever need. And all I need to know is that I can come back and see you one more time. So if you're new and you feel like you're in your final hour, from where I stand with my good friend Billy, I have a hunch you're in your finest. Thank you.